I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. This weekend, a special event takes place in Independence, maybe the first of its kind in the country. The Lit Up Literary Festival has been organized by, will be run by, and is solely for teens and young adults. We'll meet the young founder of the event, a Newbery Award winner, and the author who published her bestseller at the age of 16. Then, what do writers Susan Sontag, Dorothy Parker, and Nora Ephron have in common? Quite a bit, actually. We'll sit down with the journalist who profiled these women writers, who at one time were called Sharp, to talk about the doors they opened and how they shaped our cultural landscape. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. There are a lot of adults and teenagers who love books, and adults and teens who really love books can buy as many as they can afford or check them out from their library. If you're an adult who really, really loves books, you can go to a book festival to be with others who share your passion. But if you're a teen or a young adult, there hasn't really been a festival like that for you until now. And that's thanks in big part to a local 15-year-old, Emery Ulig. She's organized the Lit Up Festival, which has attracted attention and speakers from around the country, all coming to Independence this Saturday. And she's with us today. Emery, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
It's really great to have you here. And we'll also have two of the authors who will be part of this event with us. We'll talk to them in just a minute. But Emery, I want to start with you. When did this idea come to you to have a literary festival around teens and young adults specifically?
So about a year ago, I started thinking about ways that I could get more teenagers interested in reading. I feel like that's a really big deficit in society today. Not enough teenagers are reading, I feel like. So I wanted to come up with a way that I could get more teenagers interested in reading, and I thought maybe a book festival.
Why do you think teenagers, people your age, are reading less than they used to?
I feel like it just takes more time in a world now where we can have things instantly. You can watch a movie or watch a TV show instead, and it takes much less time, but you still get that story. And so I feel like people are moving away from books and more towards digital media.
Now, it's one thing to read or to enjoy reading, but a literary festival, what is a literary festival anyway? Maybe we should start with that.
It's a festival where authors or illustrators come and they give speeches and they give interviews, and people who just love reading can come and enjoy that and learn more about their favorite authors and books.
Kind of nerd out a little bit.
Yeah, definitely.
And I mean that in the nicest possible way. before this, I mean, what was the biggest project you had organized before trying to put this together?
I definitely hadn't organized anything as big as this. I don't really know if I had organized many projects.
So this is a big deal then.
Yeah, definitely.
How many people are you expecting on Saturday?
So far we have about 900 people registered.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So that doesn't mean that all of them will attend. But our goal for registration is 1,000.
And people do need to register, we should mention, and we'll have a little more information on that coming up. I guess I'm curious, Emery, what would be success for this festival for you? It's more than just the numbers who are coming, I assume.
Yeah, definitely. For me, success would be people just really having a good time and really enjoying it and getting something out of it.
All right. Well, we'll talk more with Emery about that, but I want to talk first with some of the authors who are actually going to be part of this festival this weekend. We've got two of them joining us today. One is Maya Van Wagenen, and at 16, she was the New York Times bestselling author of Popular, a memoir. She's 19 now, and she joins us by Skype from Statesboro, Georgia. Maya, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And we're also joined by Claire Vanderpool. She's the author of Moon Over Manifest, which won the Newbery Medal that's given for the best children's book of the year. She's also written many other books. She joins us from KMUW in Wichita. Claire, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
It's quite a lineup we've got here today. And Maya, I do want to start with you. My gosh, a teenager publishing a book that calls itself a memoir for the handful of our listeners who don't know about it. Tell us what you did in this book. It's pretty amazing.
The book is essentially a social experiment. During my eighth grade year, I took a 1950s popularity guide full of advice and applied that to my life in the border town of Brownsville, Texas.
And what kind of advice did that book contain?
It had all sorts of advice, everything from, you know, the external, like clothes, hair, and makeup, which had all been rather outdated, and then the more internal and applicable advice about essentially popular attitude was what she called it.
Now, I don't know about you, but my eighth grade years were hard enough without following 1950s fashion advice. What on earth motivated you to do this?
Well, my dad is a historian, and he bought the book, Betty Cornell's Teenage Popularity Guide, years before I was born. He picked it up at a thrift store. When my parents were cleaning out the office, the book resurfaced. My mom found it, and she handed it to me, and she said, "Maya, I have the best idea for you. You should follow this, the advice in this book, and write about what happens." And I said, "That's the worst idea I've ever heard in my life."
Right.
But I did follow through with it, and I'm very happy that I did.
So you give your mom the credit for that.
Oh, absolutely.
And how did you go about building this into a book? I mean, it's one thing to actually live those experiences as a student, as a teenager, but to turn it into a book is something different.
Yeah, absolutely. The way I structured the experiment itself lends itself to a book. Every month I would follow a different theme in Betty Cornell's book and then write about my experiences with that theme as a journal. And that journal became the book that's out now.
Let me turn to Claire Vanderpool. Claire, you've won the most prestigious award that the author of a children's book can win. That was a few years ago. Tell us about that book, Moon Over Manifest.
Moon Over Manifest came out in 2010. It's a story near and dear to my heart, not really inspired necessarily by family events, but certainly set in my home state of Kansas. Manifest is really based on the real town of Frontenac, Kansas, which is where my mother's parents were from. And, you know, when I was kind of considering writing this story, I'm really envious of Southern writers, and I always feel like, oh, they have such rich, you know, history and location. And so I wasn't sure if my home state was kind of going to be good enough. And once I started the research, I realized, oh, my gosh, you know, this town had such a rich history. It was a mining town, which you don't usually think of that in Kansas, and it had bootlegging and all these immigrants from all over the world. But really, it's a story about a girl who's been drifting from place to place during the Depression, and her dad sends her to this town, and it's just kind of a story of her trying to decide what her definition of home is going to be.
I'm sure there are many possible answers to this question, but what do you think makes for successful or high quality children's or youth or young adult literature?
Wow, give me the tough question.
Well, you're good at it, obviously.
I'm all about a good story, you know. My kids are all readers. I have four kids, and somebody asked me one time, well, how did you manage that, you know? And I just said, honestly, it was just all about having books in the house, and I never forced anybody to read, but you just put the right book in the right kid's hand. So for me, it's all about a wonderful story with, you know, real characters, and I like stories with a rich setting and, you know, just something that kind of grabs you and keeps you through the whole story.
How often do you go to literary festivals or other gatherings of authors?
A lot. Especially, you know, after the Newbery, you just get invited all over the place. So I've had the great fortune of being able to speak to a variety of audiences, you know, from kids to adults well into their senior years. So I've enjoyed all of that. And I've gotten to be at conferences where there are a lot of other authors, and that's my favorite. So this one is, I'm really looking forward to it because I hear myself speak all the time. I love to hear other authors talk about their writing and their love of stories. So I'm very much looking forward to this weekend.
Well, and let me ask you, Maya, about that. It sounds like Claire won the top award in children's literature when you were maybe just starting to read that kind of literature. I mean, what does it mean to you to be grouped into this group of people who are authors and speaking at literary festivals?
I mean, it's absolutely surreal. It's really incredible. In fact, I read Claire's book the year that I was doing the experiment. So it's really incredible to be able to meet these people whose books I loved profoundly. And it's a really wonderful experience to you know, to even be grouped among them. It's incredible.
Let me come back to the organizer of this event, Emery Ulig, who's with us here in the studio. Emery, how do you go about assembling the list of authors, and how do you get these big names like Maya Van Wagenen and Claire Vanderpool?
So the first thing that I did was I made a dream list. So I made a list of the authors that I would most personally want to have at this festival, and that I thought other people would want to see. And then from there, I went to their websites, and usually they'd have some way of contacting them. I might usually have to go through a publisher first, but I would just send out emails saying, "Hi, I'm making this book festival. It's called Lit Up. This is what it's about. I would love it if you would be able to come." And that would be it. That's kind of how I would recruit them.
And what's the response been like? Obviously, you've got quite a lineup.
Yeah, it's been pretty good. Very few people have declined just because of like travel conflicts. I think it's easier when you're 15 to get some people.
It's harder to say no to you.
Yeah.
I mean, is that true? Would you have had a difficult time saying no to this invitation?
Well, I would have anyway, but then I had the pleasure of meeting Emery in person over Christmas break, because her dad is from Wichita. So I got to go to breakfast with her mom and her sister, and Emery, did we have the best time?
Oh, it was so much fun. It was great.
We talked books for 2 hours and everything else. And if nothing else, I'm just looking forward to hanging out with Emery again. So,
well, good. And everyone can hang out with Emery. We should mention the event is on Saturday. That's this coming Saturday, May 12th. It's at the Mid-Continent Public Library's North Independence branch. And you do need to register. As Emery said, there's already 900 people signed up. So make sure that you get in on the sessions you want. And you can go to their website, which is litupfestival.org. Maya Van Wagenen, what will you be talking about at this festival?
I'm really excited because it's going to be, well, I love that it's organized by a teen, because I think oftentimes when you're in high school and middle school, people, you know, say when you grow up, you'll do cool things. And I love that it's, you know, promoting this idea that you don't have to wait to grow up. So I'm really excited for that.
I know there's different sessions and different tracks. So often there's many mm-hmm. sessions going on at the same time. You're in the track that's dealing with nonfiction.
Yes.
What kinds of things do you expect to cover? What kinds of questions do you hope to answer?
I think that as a young author, I think there's a lot of interest in how to make that happen while you're in high school and middle school. And so hopefully I'll get to talk a little bit about that, and then about fiction versus nonfiction, and the importance of recording your own story, and you know the important part that memoir plays, looking back on history. Even if you don't think that your story is going to be very interesting to someone, it's your own unique experience, and no one has that particular outlook the way that you do. And I think that that's really important.
Yeah, when Claire said a moment ago that what makes for good children or youth or young adult literature is a story, you wrote a memoir, you wrote mm-hmm. nonfiction, and yet is the same thing true?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think to add to that idea, I also love when young adult and children's fiction doesn't necessarily shy away from the difficult topics, because teens and young people are definitely faced with difficult things. And so I read something the other day that said, why is, you know, a certain book for young people if it deals with a hard subject? And I think that dealing with those things is really important, because, you know, I think that it should reflect the experiences that your readers will have. And I think that leads to more of a connection.
You know, Claire Vanderpool, one of the things our guest Emery Ulig said a little bit ago is that she thinks kids are reading less now. And that's of concern to her. Has that been your experience?
Well, like I said, with my own kids, probably not so much, although I think they are conscious of trying to make time to read. You know, they know the things that kind of pull them into wasting time or doing other things. And even my daughter that's in high school, she purposefully makes time to read in the evening just for pleasure. So, you know, it probably is true. It's challenging to get away from the screens and all that. But like I said, I think once anyone is introduced to reading and into that world where you're imagining characters and not just seeing them on a screen, I think it just is so vibrant and enjoyable that hopefully you've encountered the right book and want to go to the next one.
Emery, I want to ask you more about how this came together. Obviously, you didn't do this by yourself.
Yeah, definitely not. When I came up with the idea, I told my parents, and they were like, what if we go and we talk to a library? Maybe they'll have like the resources to actually make this happen. So the first thing I really did was I went to Mid-Continent Public Library, and I reached out to them, and they invited me to come to their headquarters to tell them about the idea. And they were really excited about it, and they've been incredible. I definitely could not do this without them.
And what were the steps? How long was this process to get to this point?
It's been about a year since I really started like thinking about it and planning and introduced this idea to the Mid-Continent Book Library. So it's been a while.
Tell me about some of the other speakers. Who are you most excited about besides the two who are on the phone right now?
I'm really excited about everyone who's coming, but personally, I'm super excited about Madeline Miller. She wrote Song of Achilles, and I just adore that book. I read it a long time ago, and I just like cried through all of it. It was amazing, and I'm really excited I'll get the chance to meet her and actually interview her.
Is that how that's going to work? You're going to actually interview people on stage?
Yeah. So I'll be interviewing Madeline Miller and Rainbow Rowell, who I'm also super excited about coming.
Tell me about Rainbow Rowell.
So she's written a lot of really amazing teenage books. So my favorites personally are Eleanor and Park, Fangirl, and Carry On. They're all really amazing, and I'm so excited I'll get to meet her.
You have quite a repertoire of books that you have read, Emery.
Yeah, I like to read a lot.
Maya Van Wagenen, were you a big reader before you became a writer?
Oh, absolutely. My bookshelves are packed, and I love going to these festivals because I always get new books to read, and that makes me really happy.
You come home with a suitcase that's heavier to lift than you left.
Oh, absolutely. That's the mark of a good book festival.
Have you continued to write? It's been a few years since you, when you have such success with your first big book, it must be hard to know what to do next.
Oh, definitely. And I was also in high school, so it kind of put everything on hold. But I am writing full time now, which is really exciting. So hopefully it won't be too long before the next book comes out.
Can you tell us what you're working on, or is that a secret?
It's a fiction project, so it is different. But it's for a young adult audience.
Claire, have you written for adult audiences as well?
Technically, my books are considered middle grade or, you know, children's books, kind of a little bit of a crossover in a way, I guess. But I really consider my books for anyone, any reader.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that a lot from writers of youth and young adult books, especially, mm-hmm. that there's no shame in an adult reading a book that says young adult on the front.
Yeah. And, you know, really, other than the fact that my main characters are young, you know, I don't really make decisions writing to a particular audience. I just write the story.
Does it change the vocabulary or the complexity of the plot or anything like that?
My stories are fairly complex. Both stories kind of somewhat have a story within a story. But I think, you know, a good reader can follow along. And what I loved about reading as a kid was just the fact that some of the books I read, you know, like the Narnia stories, you could read them at one level as a fifth grader or a sixth grader. And then I could read them again as, you know, in my 20s and enjoy them in a different way. So that's the kind of story I like to write, that is fairly layered, that you can read again and encounter something different as you get a little older.
Emery, who are you reading right now?
Right now I'm reading several different books, actually. I'm reading a lot of Kurt Vonnegut right now, so I'm reading Cat's Cradle right now. I just recently finished Sirens of Titan, which was incredible.
Wow. That's the kind of material that not every adult would be excited about having on their kid's bookshelf.
Yeah, I'm a big sci-fi fan, so...
Very good. So let me ask all of you before we go, as you approach this festival, what would you like to see happen? What kinds of conversations do you think can happen only in a place like this where readers and authors like this all come together? Let me start with you, Claire.
I look forward to any opportunity I can get to talk to young readers, especially high school age, because maybe I don't get that opportunity as often. I'm looking forward to this kind of format also, because usually I give talks, but this is more of that interview format conversation. So when you get to hear questions kind of off the cuff, what's on people's minds, and you know, especially it's what an honor when people want to talk to you about your own story. So I just love the spontaneity of it.
That's great. And Maya Van Wagenen, what are you looking forward to? What do you hope comes of it?
The same, actually. And I'm really excited to talk to other authors and to other readers and writers, you know, young writers. And I think that it's going to be really exciting. I think we'll all just inspire each other. And that's what I love most about a book festival, is how motivated and inspired it leaves everybody, I think.
And Emery Ulig, where does this go from here? Will this be an annual event?
Yeah. I definitely hope it will become an annual event. And then also, we're planning to spread it into other cities. We've had some people contact us about wanting to hold a lit up in their own city. And so we're going to create a kit that hopefully would let people hold their own lit up in their own cities. And it should be pretty cool.
Remind us of the details. It's this Saturday.
Yes. So this Saturday, May 12th, it's from 8 in the morning to 8 p.m., but you can come at any time. It's at North Independence Library. The website is litupfestival.org.
And there's a whole schedule there.
Yeah.
But you do want people to register.
Yes, that'd be great if you could register.
That's Emily Ulig. Emery Ulig. She's the organizer of the Lit Up Festival. Also, we've been joined by I can't get any of the names right today. Maya Van Wagenen, who wrote Popular, a memoir. Thanks for joining us by Skype, Maya.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
And Claire Vanderpool, who wrote Moon Over Manifest and won the Newbery Medal. She joined us from KMUW in Wichita. Thanks, Claire.
You're welcome. Thank you.
When we come back, we'll continue to talk about the impact of writers who happen to be women. In this case, critics and essayists and social commentators, women who through American literary history dared to have opinions, and what they endured, and what they transformed. Stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, Steve spoke with the former editor-in-chief of USA Today about the future of print journalism and the First Amendment. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. And join us tomorrow, learn about the volunteers who work on suicide prevention hotlines, and also find out how that work influences their lives. That's tomorrow on Up to Date. Today, though, Dorothy Parker, Susan Sontag, Pauline Kael, Nora Ephron, they were all women writers, and not just writers, writers who in a literary world dominated by men, or at least so it is sometimes thought, dared to write their opinions, strong opinions, controversial opinions, what for each of them at some point someone called sharp opinions. Sharp is the title of a new book about the lives of 10 women writers from the 20th century, their impact and the connections between them. And joining us today from the studios of NPR West is Michelle Dean. She's a journalist and critic herself and the author of Sharp, The Women Who Made an Art of Having an Opinion. Michelle, welcome to Up to Date.
Lovely to join you.
Glad you could be here. So let's talk about that title. At the very end of the book, you say in your afterword that you had a great deal of time to reflect on what exactly people meant when they called these women sharp. What did you come up with?
Well, it's a compliment, obviously, that people pay specifically to women. I mean, men are also sometimes called sharp, but it comes up very often in terms of complimenting women writers. And it's meant to say, you know, you're perceptive, you've put your finger on something, but there's also this sort of tailwind mm-hmm. of destructiveness or meanness that attaches to a compliment like that. Mm-hmm. The idea that they had somehow been cutting or destructive. And that was interesting to me, like that duality between both the idea that it was good for women to have put their finger on something and somehow perceived as, yeah, mean.
Is it a matter of their writing being different, actually being sharper than the men who were writing contemporaneously with them, or was it just perceived as such?
I think it was both, you know. I think there is something to it. I don't think that there are biological differences in the way that men and women write, but I do think that social position plays into it, especially when you're a critic and you're commenting on the culture or on politics or whatever. And the social position of women, of the women in my book, who were all writing sort of in the early and mid 20th century, you know, were all writing in a very male dominated world, and that meant that they were always writing as sort of outsiders looking in or trying to get the attention of men in a way that that forced them to be a little bit sharper than your average young male writer who might have been trying to break in the same way.
Well, and in that period, not only were they trying to make their way in a world with a lot of male writers, but they also were writing reviews or offering commentary in response or critique of things that were written by men.
Yep. A lot of the time.
So one of the things, though, you question is whether we really should regard the literary world of the 20th century as so male-dominated.
Right. I mean, well, in the sense that, you know, there are a couple of questions about how to define the literary world of the time. I mean, there's what was actually going on in terms of numbers of writers and writers that were recognized as having sort of, you know, superior or having produced superior work in that period, which traditionally we think of mostly of the modernists and of novelists like Hemingway or Fitzgerald. That's the way we generally have told American literary history. But you know, some of the voices that have also endured from that time, I mean, Dorothy Parker in particular, people still quote her to each other. Mm-hmm. And so the legacy of that period is in part defined by women. And that's something, yeah, that I'm trying to point out in the book.
Well, and to that end, I mean, each of these writers you name are significant as writers, not merely as women writers.
Exactly.
And yet, do you think there are some commonalities that unite their work? Is there something that is true of all 10 of them other than being called sharp?
I mean, you know, I think that they all do sometimes have a tonal commonality here and there. And I kind of think that grows out of their social position rather than any particular natural propensity or
sure.
anything. I mean, also there are some other like commonalities of background. Specifically, most of the women in this book were Jewish. And so there are certain things that did kind of unite them. But mostly, I mean, they were doing what men were doing, which is, you know, writing about all sorts of subjects, writing from all sorts of different perspectives, sometimes writing fiction, sometimes writing criticism. But always they had this sort of analytical take on things. Even actually when they were writing fiction, there's often usually a lot of social commentary embedded in their novels.
Let's talk about some of them specifically. And you've already
sure.
made reference to Dorothy Parker. Why is she your starting place? She's the first writer you profile. Obviously, she's the earliest, but why is that?
I think that a lot of this particular position that I'm chronicling, and obviously, you know, the book is not meant to cover the position of all women writers in American literary history, but of this particular position I'm chronicling, of the woman who's sort of acidly commenting on the scene, either the cultural or political scene, is something that Dorothy Parker pioneered. And because she actually happened to, you know, come up as a writer in a very particular period of American literary history where writers were actually celebrities, probably the only time in which this was true, you know, the gossip pages would cover what she and the members of the Algonquin Roundtable were doing, mm-hmm. which is not something you really see very much of anymore unless you're like Salman Rushdie and dating stars. but, you know, because of that, she became sort of a signature figure, and in one way or another, nearly every other woman in the book, however different they might have been from her, and obviously somebody like Hannah Arendt, who's also in the book, and even Mary McCarthy, are very different writers than Dorothy Parker, ended up having to sort of respond to the idea that they were occupying a Parkerish position, because she was always described as like the only woman at the Algonquin Round Table, which is actually not totally historically true. There were a few other women there, but that's the way the media defined her, and this idea that you were the one exceptional woman who was going to be admitted to the conversation was something that they all had to wrestle with, and she represented that.
Your book is a little bit biography, it's a little bit literary review, but I was struck by some of the biographical details about Dorothy Parker, and that her start in the writing world in a very real way is about as stereotypically female as one could be. She lands this job at Vogue in 1916,
yep.
but not exactly the typical Vogue writer, it turns out.
No, and she didn't really, you know, they had her writing captions for fashion illustrations, since she would write underminery sort of captions. I mean, the most famous one being, yeah, brevity is the soul of lingerie. And yeah, she didn't really enjoy working there very much. Vogue at that time was probably a little more prim. She said in a later interview, she probably would have fit in better in the Vogue of the 60s or 70s. But you know, at the time she was working there.
Yeah. And that was the job as a writer that she could get.
Yeah, exactly. And she was contributing to Vanity Fair, and she eventually moved over to the early Vanity Fair. But yeah, it's funny. And it's actually kind of beautiful the way that she sort of just resisted the role that they wanted her to fit as a woman writer. And she couldn't do it. She couldn't just write prim little things about outfits.
I want to invite our listeners to the conversation. Are there women writers, and we might even say, for purposes of this conversation, opinionated women writers, whose being opinionated has had an impact on you, whose writing has affected your life, or maybe even your own way of communicating? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also tweet at us. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You know, we're talking, I should mention, with Michelle Dean. She's the author of Sharp, The Women Who Made an Art of Having an Opinion. And Michelle, it's interesting to me to see Hannah Arendt, who you just mentioned. I think of her as... well, it's very different than, say, Dorothy Parker. She writes political theory. She was into philosophy, existential philosophy, not quite in the same category, especially as some of your later 20th century authors you profile, Susan Sontag or Pauline Kael. Tell me a little bit about Hannah Arendt as a writer.
Well, she also wrote book reviews. I mean, you know, she was also, it's funny, you say she was into philosophy. She would have said, I'm not a philosopher, I'm a theorist. Mm-hmm. And she tended to tie her work very, very strongly to observations of the concrete social and political scene that she was in. And that was kind of how she came into it for me. And also because she had this moment where she was sort of identified as this sharp person who had said something ultimately destructive and controversial, which is when she wrote a book called Eichmann in Jerusalem, where she was talking about the trial of Adolf Eichmann, who was a Nazi official who was in charge of the Final Solution, who had fled to South America and hid there for many years until the Israelis found him and, you know, actually forcibly removed him and brought him back to Israel and put him on trial. And she wrote a chronicle of the trial that was ultimately very controversial, and which put her in the public eye as someone who had said something that said a few different things. In fact, you know, she was criticized about her accounts of certain aspects of the Holocaust and of what went on in Germany, but also just for that phrase for which she's very famous, of the banality of evil, which many people misread as her saying that evil was, you know, kind of harmless or something like that, whereas she meant something much more profound by it. And that moment of controversy was interesting to me. And also she was interesting to me because she was very, very close friends with Mary McCarthy, who was probably a writer who seems to fit the paradigm a little bit more closely.
Well, and one of the things that you say you wanted to do by writing this book is to lift up the connections between these women. They've been biographically described separately, but no one's really linked them together this way. What was her relationship with Mary McCarthy?
Well, they were very close friends. I mean, in fact, one of the reasons that we have some of Arendt's work as clearly in English as we do is that Mary was among the people who would help her fashion her English, because obviously English was not Hannah Arendt's first language. And so, you know, there was both a personal connection that was very close, and there's a great collection of her letters, of their letters called Between Friends, that, you know... They were both gossipy and they talked about ideas a lot. And there's something very inspirational about that friendship. And it's a kind of friendship that isn't actually chronicled a lot, or at least wasn't until very recently. This idea that women have both the personal connection and might talk about, I don't know, the romantic connections in their lives, but also talk about, you know, their professional work and their ideas. And that's something that's sort of very uplifting. And they were very much a close unit. There were people who said, you know, I thought Mary was in love with Hannah.
Hmm. Sometimes they are close, these women, high-profile women writers you talk about. Sometimes, though, they're rivals. Sometimes they don't get along at all.
That's true. Although I think sometimes the rivalries were also overstated. You know, the culture loves a cat fight, and or what they perceive as a cat fight. But definitely there were tensions. You know, Pauline Kael and Joan Didion didn't like each other very much.
And what was that about? Was it a professional conflict or was it personal?
It's curious, you know, because definitely it was professional in the sense that they, you know, specifically Kael had criticized Didion in print and you know, hadn't liked her novels in particular, had found them sort of silly and said so in print. And that was never going to be like a great opening gambit for a friendship. You know, they it's funny because they were also very similar in many ways. Mm-hmm. You know, they had similar backgrounds in California. Not similar backgrounds, but they were both from California and both very much defined themselves as West Coast sort of voices. And they also both had this reputation for sort of toughness, critical toughness. And it's funny, occasionally they did agree. My favorite evidence of their agreement is both of them, when Manhattan came out, Woody Allen's Manhattan, both of them observed, you know, only Woody Allen could sell this kind of thing where he's dating a 16-year-old in a movie. And it's interesting that they both made that observation so early on.
Which is a sharp, if you will, a biting observation that gets at more than the quality of the literature. It's a critique of the person, Woody Allen, but of the fact that Woody Allen as a man got away with that, too.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting to see that, especially in the context of our current cultural conversations, mm-hmm. you know, that actually people were calling it out at the time. It's just that it didn't get traction in the way that it can now.
Which kind of raises the question about all of these writers. To make their name as women writers, were they in fact feminists? Were they making statements on behalf of the advancement of women? Was that their purpose behind their writing?
So in general, no. And I think actually, you know, the women in the book mostly were somewhere between ambivalent and hostile to what I'm going to call movement feminism, meaning the specific sort of thing where people met together and marched in political action. That doesn't necessarily mean in any of their cases that they didn't see, you know, their reaction to their work or the way that people talk to them is gendered. Most of them, you know, Joan Didion wrote a very famous critique of the second wave of feminism. But even in a recent interview a few years ago, she said, you know, that was an observation of a specific point in time. I don't know if I still feel that way about feminism. Mm-hmm. But all of these women were what I try to politely call oppositional spirits, meaning that, you know, group politics were not easy for them. And that is true in more contexts than social movements. And so, you know, they just they've found it difficult to flatten their own perspective or their own like light form of contrarianism in a way that would have been required if you wanted to, you know, just subsume yourself and become a very strong activist, which is sometimes what's required. It's just not what they could do.
Mentioned Pauline Kael a moment ago. She's another writer you feature, and of course Pauline Kael, mm-hmm. I think is clearly best known for her film reviews in The New Yorker, which she did mm-hmm. for most of her writing life. How hard was it for a person as a film reviewer primarily to really put forward commentary, opinion that is truly transformational, that truly has an impact? I mean, she's reviewing movies.
Well, we think movies are not central to like social and political life now, but in the time when Kael was writing, I mean, they were, you know, people went to them. They were more of a culturally defining event because, you know, you couldn't go and watch Netflix instead of mm-hmm. Going to the theater. So when she was writing about them, it was in an entirely different context. I think for her, those movies were never totally separable from the wider context of American culture. I don't think for her that was actually like a big question at all.
In fact, that was an arena where you really could see culture crystallized in this very clear way.
Exactly.
You know, I do have to ask, you didn't necessarily claim that this was a comprehensive book, that you were capturing all the important women writers, but of the 10 who are prominently featured, well, in fact, there's an 11th who gets sort of half a chapter, and that's Zora Neale Hurston, but she's the only woman of color profiled in the book. Why is that?
Well, so the book is actually about a bunch of women who actually knew each other and defined themselves by each other's careers, right? And so the problem that I ran into in it was that, in fact, you know, most of these writers were working in what I can just call a segregated intellectual and literary atmosphere, where in general they didn't seem to read Black writers, they didn't meet Black writers, they didn't talk to Black writers. You know, the one exception that sometimes pops up is James Baldwin, but even he was not close to anybody in the book. And I wanted to acknowledge that in the book. So I talked about Zora Neale Hurston because I feel that tonally, especially when I read some of her newspaper columns, tonally she sounded a lot like these women. But because frankly, the racism of American society, she wasn't eligible for the sort of particular position these women were put in of being, you know, the one exceptional woman that people would listen to. And that's entirely, you know, the product of racism. But I wanted to acknowledge the ways in which this tradition also excluded other people, that it wasn't totally triumphal and a triumph for all women or something like that.
So in a very different spirit, a writer like Nora Ephron makes the list. She did a lot of writing, but she also brought the world sort of these pop cultural romantic comedies like You've Got Mail and Sleepless in Seattle. How does a writer like that, and that you're getting into the later part of the 20th century now with those works of art, how does that fit into the canon of opinionated women writers, as you say?
Well, it's funny because Nora is in many ways the person who inspired the book more directly than the others. I mean, I'd read some of them. I'm actually Canadian, and I don't think that I was...
Truth comes out.
Well, I always use that as a get-out-of-jail-free card. But, but you know, I don't think I was aware that she had been a journalist before she had directed those romantic comedies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm perhaps also a bit too young to have been... I certainly wasn't alive when she was writing.
No, I think a lot of people wouldn't know that, actually.
Yeah, actually. And a few years before she died, somebody had handed me a copy of one of her early books, which is called Crazy Salad, and I read it, and I was really struck by this voice that was coming out on the page and how good it was and how direct and, for lack of a better word, sharp it was. And it got me thinking a lot about, like, the things that we aren't told about our own literary or cultural history, which is in many ways what inspired me to go on with the book. So, you know, Nora Ephron's journalism is actually very serious in my opinion. It's a serious commentary on gender relations of her time and also on media. And yeah, there's very much something about the way that she delivered it where it looks deceptively like, you know, like pop culture riffs or something like that. But there's a very serious mind behind it. And I guess I wanted her to get the recognition for that.
Can we talk about the sexism that all of these women as writers, and perhaps every woman who is a writer, encounters in one way or another? One of the things you talk about is the words used to describe the work, and we've already mentioned sharp, but in your chapter on Joan Didion's work, you talk about how it's often not called tough, but it's called elegant and glamorous, and those aren't entirely positive expressions there.
Yeah, I mean, you see that actually in the way that there's sort of like an interesting reevaluation of Didion going on sometimes right now, because some people have decided that she's too elegant or glamorous or something like that. And it's interesting because it is a way of feminizing what she's doing, right? It's a way of making sure that you remind people that she's a woman, and a woman first, when in fact I find her work very steely in literally all of it, although sometimes some try to say that she seems neurotic or neurasthenic. For me, it's not like that. And I think, you know, there is something about the language of the way that we describe these people. I mean, when Susan Sontag first published her work, which was acknowledged to be brilliant at the time, I found a bunch of reviewers just calling her a girl. She's a very smart girl.
Wow.
Just a way of putting her in her place, you know? And I mean, it didn't really work on Sontag. She wasn't that kind of person. But yeah, that's the way that people do it.
And how much has that changed? I mean, do you feel like it may be a different context, but are women writers still encountering that kind of sexism in the responses to their work? Or how has that sexism changed is maybe the better question.
They have. I think obviously a book reviewer who at this point called a serious literary writer a girl would be widely ridiculed on social media. So, you know, the terms have changed, right? But it does still feel like people want to remind you of your unreliability all the time as a woman writer. Mm. Just this idea that you're fundamentally more emotional or you're not operating on the same register as serious men are. And that's changing. But we're also in this era where women writers are exposed to social media, which in many ways has made it easier for the sort of lower common denominator to get at them.
Right. That did lead me to wonder about this book, how these writers would have been received in today's social media age. What if Dorothy Parker had to deal with tweets about her writing?
It's true. I think in general she would have had a really excellent Twitter account, but because it just happened to be a form that she would excel at. But yeah, I think it would be difficult, right? You know, it is difficult for literally every woman writer that I know, and I know a lot of them, to just live in this atmosphere of constant feedback from the general public.
I mean, before we let you go, Michelle Dean, you are a writer and reviewer yourself. You've won awards for your critical work in the New Republic, New Yorker, The Nation, that writing. Has this had an impact on you? Has it made you think differently about your own career, learning about these writers?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, you know, the book is not written in the first person. You don't hear about me in it, really. But the book was an intensely personal project because in many ways, the question I was trying to ask with it was, how does one do this, right? Like, how do you spend your whole life analyzing things, which is not always something that people want to hear. People don't always want to hear from, like, the kid who thinks the emperor has no clothes, right? You know?
Yeah.
And that was... learning how these women did it was extremely instructive.
That's Michelle Dean. She's a journalist and critic. She's the author of Sharp, The Women Who Made an Art of Having an Opinion. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Remember, yesterday on the program, we reviewed the Kansas legislature's veto session. You can hear that conversation in all our previous episodes at kcur.org/uptodate. Don't forget to find us on Twitter, too. We're at kcuruptodate, and I'm at ptsbrian. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook as well. Tomorrow, we learn what a TIF is, and we find out how they've been used to help fund redevelopment throughout Missouri. We'll also learn why the practice has become so controversial. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.